Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I have my water. I need my water. You know, I feel a little bit out of my element here. I live at sea level. And so I don't spend a whole lot of time at this altitude. So if I sit down partway through my talk, I'm also a bit out of my element because I'm kind of outside educause. I live in another country, 3 time zones away. And being a bit on the outside, you know, I come here to a talk like this, and it's almost like kind of coming to see the establishment. And I don't get a chance to talk to this particular group of people a whole lot. And so, you know, what am I going to say? And of course, I'm here at this conference in this beautiful location, and thank you so much for inviting me. I'm 30 years of tradition. I'm wondering, you know, like, how can I do anything different, be distinct? Because, you know, I am a kind of an outsider. And I was thinking yesterday that maybe I should do something like quote some Che Guevara or something like that. And I thought I looked through and I couldn't find any good quotes, but I did bring the book. So I figure I'm probably the only person at this conference to wave a copy of Che Guevara at the podium. And if not, then I'm probably in very good company. Okay, well, I thought that was pretty funny. It took me a long time to come up with that. Today's talk is Principles of Distributed Representation. And when you looked at the outline, you're probably thinking to yourself, oh no, another metadata paper. And if you're like me, you're probably tired of metadata papers. And today's talk is sort of about metadata, and I will talk about metadata because I did kind of promise that I would. And I've learned from hard experience that you really should talk about whatever's in the abstract. But today's talk is also not about metadata. It's about knowledge. It's about the changing model or picture of learning that new technologies brings to us. It talks about networks in specific. And then near the end, I begin to apply this to metadata. Now, I'm going to talk a lot about things that aren't metadata, therefore, but as I go through this, you should be thinking, as I go along, that each thing that I say is about metadata. I know that doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but it'll come a bit clearer. I hope it comes clearer. We begin with knowledge. I have to begin with knowledge because my training is in philosophy, and if I don't begin with knowledge, I'm kind of lost, you know, like in a rowboat without a paddle or whatever. This would be different here. But we have this picture, don't we, of what knowledge is. And the picture, I've sort of caricatured it on the screen here. Knowledge is like entities in the brain, corresponding to sentences like, Paris is the capital of France. And if somebody asked you, what is your knowledge like that Paris is the capital of France? You'd probably talk about the sentence and the meanings of the words and how the words go together in a syntax that forms a grammar. And there's a fairly established theory, and some of the more recent writers, people like Chomsky and Fodor, talk about the writing in the brain. And we can think about that literally. People like Fodor think about that literally, or we can think about that metaphorically. But even so, that's kind of the picture of knowledge that we have. It is what I sometimes think of as the information theoretic view, where communication involves getting a bit of knowledge, like that sentence, Paris is the capital of France, from point A to point B, from professor to student, from speaker, me, to you, people in the audience. And the whole theory of distance learning is wrapped up around this concept. So you get, for example, Moore's concept of transactional distance, where you're trying to bridge this gap. Hey, there's been so many conferences bridging the gap between this and that, and trying to improve the communication and create interaction. I read about interaction. I do have a background in computers, so I think checksum. Oh yeah, he's invented checksums. More, transactional distance, the physical separation that leads to a psychological and communications gap, a space of potential misunderstanding between the inputs of instructor and those of the learner. It's communication theoretic, isn't it? We're talking signal sent, signal received, noise, feedback, all of that sort of thing. That's the traditional picture. In effect, knowledge is like sentences. Those of you who are familiar with RDF, probably all familiar with RDF, you know, this subject, verb, object type of formation. Vocabulary in a language is unambiguous. The fact that you invited me here from another country, three time zones away, you presumed that when I used words, I'd probably use words in much the same way you use words, and if I said the word Paris, you'd pretty much get what I meant. I depend on that sometimes, and certainly I'm depending on that at the moment, because otherwise, you know, it'd be like that commercial where I'm talking Russian or something. Description is pretty much concrete. This is a bottle of water. This has a blue label. A horse is a horse. Of course, of course. I couldn't resist. Yeah, you get on a roll when you're typing these slides. That has gotten me in trouble before. I don't always delete. Anyhow. But none of this is true. And not only is it not true empirically, it can't be true. Because if it were true, then context would have no effect on truth or meaning. But context sensitivity is everywhere. And I've sort of spewed a list of references there for you. Wittgenstein, meaning is use. Quine, the indeterminacy of reference, the indeterminacy of language. When a native points to something and says, Gavagai, does he mean rabbit or does he mean spirit of my ancestor? Van Frassen, scientific explanation. A is the cause of B, can only be understood in the context of an alternative event, C. Why did the plants grow? Well, the plants grow because I put seeds in the ground, as opposed to the plants grew because I put fertilizer in the ground, as opposed to the plants grow because, well, there's photosynthesis and there's sunlight and all of that, as opposed to the plants grow because God wills it. The explanation depends on your context. Hansen, causation. What was the cause of the accident? Well, it was the brakes. It was the drunken driver. It was the bush at the side of the road. George Lakoff, categorization. Different cultures organize the world different ways. There is indeed, says Lakoff, a culture out there that classifies woman, fire, and dangerous things as one category and everything else as another category. Robert Stalnaker, David Lewis, modality, the logics of necessity, impossibility, are based on the most similar possible world. Well, what makes a possible world the most similar? Well, that depends on how you view the world that you're in. What we know, crucially, depends on our point of view. Tried to come up with a bit of a diagram there. This is a new one for me, but in the center there, that's reality, properly so called. And then around the outside of that diagram, we have four points of view. And you can see as we each look at reality from our different point of view, our view of reality is slightly different, which I've represented by reorganizing the letters in the little boxes. But in fact, all we have is our point of view. All we have are the things in the little boxes. And language, which is what we use to try to get at what's in the middle, is at best an approximation and at worst a parody of what knowledge is actually there. That's a hard concept. So I'm going to draw it out a bit, some of the implications of this. And again, remember, I'm talking about knowledge, but I'm also talking about metadata. Oh, just before I go on, my clock is flashing 1:44, which I know it's not. So if somebody could like wave to me when I've got 10 minutes left, how am I doing right now, please? I have another hour. I'm just kidding. I could linger on any one of these slides for another hour, but I won't because... All right. Knowledge is subsymbolic. That is to say, what we know is not isomorphic with the words that express what we know. Another way of saying the same things, and those of you as educators, I'm sure, have seen this in practice, the mere possession of the words is not the same as knowing something. The knowing of something depends not simply on the words, but on the application of the words in the appropriate context. And since I'll refer to Michael Polanyi here as well and point out that a lot of knowledge indeed cannot even be expressed in words. Personal knowledge, tacit knowledge, the skill of how to throw a dart. Believe me, if that knowledge could be expressed in words, I would be a good dart player. Second, crucially, knowledge is distributed. There is no specific entity that constitutes the knowledge that Paris is the capital of France. Now think about how that contrasts with the picture I drew at the beginning of this talk, where we have this thing in our mind that's the knowledge that Paris is the capital of France. Well, that knowledge doesn't occupy a particular place in the mind. It's spread out. It's in, you know, billions of neurons. But not only that, it's not even completely and entirely contained in the mind. My knowledge that Paris is the capital of France is partially contained in you. Because I need to know what the word Paris means, what the concept of a capital is, what the word is. Oxford English Dictionary has, 15 pages trying to define the word is. There is no given person who has that particular paradigm bit of knowledge, Paris is the capital of France. Now, I know that sounds unintuitive. So let me give you a slightly more intuitive way of representing this. Well, this morning, if you were awake, and I sincerely hope you weren't, you saw the space shuttle come in for a landing. And it did, in fact, land. Rock and roll. We liked that. Where does the knowledge of how to launch, fly, and land a shuttle reside? What person has this knowledge? And clearly, as soon as you reflect on that, you realize, nobody. Nobody could. There is so much involved in the launching, flying, and landing of a shuttle that no one person could possibly have a shuttle. Have that knowledge. That was kind of an interesting slip. Some people know how to make shuttle tires. Other people know how to make shuttle tiles. Other people know how to do the launch sequence. You know, somebody knows how to do that countdown, 10, 9, 8. I guess it's a skill. You know, there was somebody in the shuttle knows how to go out of the shuttle and pull the little bits of paper out from in between the tiles. Somebody else knows. You get the idea. What I'm saying is that all knowledge is like that, not just the complicated stuff. Because, again, this is my background philosophy. As soon as you begin pushing even the simple stuff, like Paris is the capital of France, it gets really complicated in a hurry. What do you mean by capital? That's exactly, or you know, what do you mean by is? Knowledge is interconnected. This is very different from the traditional picture. The traditional picture, you have a sentence, Paris is the capital of France, that's it, you're done, you've got your knowledge. But Paris is the capital of France, that bit of knowledge is actually a part of other bits of knowledge, and other bits of knowledge are parts of the knowledge that Paris is the capital of France. The knowledge that countries have capitals is part of that knowledge. The sentence, Paris is the capital of France, wouldn't make any sense to you if countries didn't have capitals. You know, and it's playing with these sorts of connections that's the basis for a whole lot of jokes, right? What's the capital of France? Well, about $23. That sort of thing. You mess around the preconceived understandings of the words. Even sentences like ducks are animals are related in a complex chain to the sentence Paris is the capital of France. It's like Quine said, it's a web. Knowledge is personal. And you probably, if you go to knowledge management conferences, you hear Polanyi, and they talk about, oh, let's extract all of this tacit knowledge and we'll put it in the database. And if you read Polanyi, it's exactly what you can't do, because the knowledge that's in your head is embedded, it's personal, it's sitting there in a context. If you just pull it out and put it up, it doesn't make sense anymore. Your belief that Paris is the capital of France is quite literally, I don't mean this metaphorically, it's literally different from my belief that Paris is the capital of France. And if you think about it, think about the word Paris. Alright, how many of you thought of the word plaster? One, two, okay. How many of you thought about the word Hilton? Now, I've used two examples here. We got a few people raising their hands and everybody else not raising their hands. But those are the first two things that come up in my mind, so I'm wondering what you're... Like I said, I'm a bit out of my element here, right? I say the word Paris, I have certain associations. You say the word Paris, you have different associations, and now I'm wondering what they are. I have one set of thoughts when I think of Paris. You have a different set of thoughts. Why aren't they the same? If knowledge is according to that traditional picture, that should be the same. If I mean Paris, I mean the same exact same thing as you. But it's clearly and evidently not the case. Fifth, knowledge is emergent. And yeah, I know we got Stephen Johnson and others saying emergent this, emergent that, and you know it's the new buzzword. The knowledge that Paris is the capital of France, we have this kind of abstract idea that we share the knowledge that Paris is the capital of France. It's like this platonic ideal almost that we're trying to get at. And what I'm saying here is that this concept is emergent from the many individual bits of knowledge inside all of yourselves that Paris is the capital of France. Now the thing about emergence, and I don't see people write about this, so maybe it's new, but I don't know. Maybe I'm just naive. Emergence is not a causal phenomenon. Well, I mean, okay, it is a causal phenomenon. You go to the micro levels and bits and atoms and all of that, you can draw a causal picture, but the causal picture is so complicated, nobody can understand it. It's like, you know, the weather is a causal picture. But, you know, who's going to draw the line from this to this to this and make an accurate prediction, 43 years from now? It's not going to happen. But at the higher level, emergence is a phenomenon of recognition. You need a viewer. You need a perceiver. You don't get away without having one. Think about a picture of Richard Nixon on the television. You see the television, what you really see are all those little pixels, right? And you know this, you've heard this story before, but you look at all those, and the way those pixels are organized, and the way those pixels are colored, the picture of Richard Nixon emerges from the television. But if you had never heard of Richard Nixon, you would not recognize that as a picture of Richard Nixon. At the very best, it'd be some guy. And if you're an alien from another planet, maybe visiting the people on the space shuttle, I like to go with the theme, then you're not even sure whether it's a human, a rock formation, could be anything. Emergence requires perception. It requires a perceiver. That is why it is context sensitive, and that is why knowledge is context sensitive. Here's another buzzword, the wisdom of crowds. What does that mean? Knowledge is distributed. Each one of us is a piece of the puzzle. And we don't acquire this piece. You know, it's not like somebody comes to a podium and talks a piece and you're sitting there and you're like, okay, got it. Right? It doesn't work that way. As you sit there, indeed, even as this talk is happening, you are not simply acquiring the words that I give you. And I sincerely hope not, although maybe I'll start reading Shane, see what happens. No, I'm kidding. Right? The stuff's coming in, but then it meshes and smooshes with everything else that you've got going on. And what happens in your mind is you create something new out of it. And then that new thing becomes another piece of the puzzle, and it gets fed back in. And back and forth it goes, back and forth over and over again. Creation, on this model, is the process of acquisition. You get the input in, the talk, the website, the paper, the television show, the trip through the forest. You remix it. You take a bit here, and a bit here, and a bit here, and a bit here, you put it together, sometimes in a new arrangement, sometimes in an arrangement you're comfortable with. You repurpose it. Or you reshape it. You frame it according to your own background knowledge, your own beliefs, your own understandings of the word. This guy at the front of the room says the word Paris. You take that word and shape that, mold that into a place where it fits in your mind. And then you feed it forward. You complain to the organizing committee after the talk. just kidding. If Alan Levine's in here, he's probably blogging this. You pass it along. And this process happens over and over again. And each individual person does this, and it creates this network of meaning. It's not simply a physical network. You read people like Laszlo or Watts, and they talk a lot about the structures and the structural properties of networks. But what's interesting and important are the semantical properties of networks. And the semantical properties are what is found, or what are found, when we look at these concepts as they're being molded, as they're being passed along, and what emerges from them. Need water. Reminder to self, keep sentences to less than 20 words. Yeah. Hence, for example, you've seen this before in the literature. We'll go back to the 1970s. Thomas Kuhn, Structure of Scientific Revolutions. What is it to know in, as he says, normal science? Well, to know, to learn a science, to learn a discipline, says Kuhn, is not to learn a whole bunch of facts, but to learn how to solve the problems at the back of the chapter. And as someone who's struggled with those problems at the back of the chapter, I can tell you, the stuff that you need to solve the problems isn't in the text that preceded the problems. I have analyzed this. More modern, Etienne Wenger, learning is participation in the community of practice. And again, it's the same concept here that's coming out. It's instead of learning as being this acquisitions of sets of facts, rather it's learning as immersion into an environment. Now your metadata should be like that too. Properties of successful networks. I like to adapt. And so yesterday we heard Charles Vest talking about the three successful or three attributes of a successful university system. He had that nice list. Of course, I'm sitting there in the back of the very back of the room, sitting there. Yeah, but it's the Times of London. They have an agenda. Everything is context, right? But the attributes were important. And the attributes that he identified were right. And I think they're vital and they're fundamental, which is kind of neat because, you know, I come in thinking I'm going to do a talk on principles of representation, and I come in and I pick up the principles from the opening talk. But that's how this works. You probably thought the talk was static, dynamic, something that existed before it actually happened. But that's not how it works. When the knowledge is in this network, in this flow, interacting back and forward, it quite literally changes from day to day. Charles Best, three key attributes. Diversity. I've kind of recast that as many objectives. He was talking about, you know, the different types of institutions. You got, you know, your land grants, you've got your publics, etc. Don't know all the different types of institutions here, but there were many. Interwoven. For Charles Vest, interwoven is teaching and research. I didn't come up quite right. But the idea is you're not focused on a single thing. You're not doing just one thing. And then crucially, and this is the core, of course, behind MIT's open courseware and the many other projects that he mentioned, it's open. The system is open. The network is open. It admits many minds, many points of view. And that openness is what enables the communication and the exchange of concepts and ideas to happen. That creates that network effect. Diversity. That means if diversity is true, if diversity is a virtue, then its converse is not, right? So the idea of making everything the same, making everything of anything the same, is fundamentally misguided. Now, many of you work on something called standards. Standards is, by definition, the making of everything the same. So we have a tension here. Interwoven. The idea that our different activities are distinct is fundamentally misguided. Those of you who were took in the talk on what the next generation expects of us will have gotten the flavor of this, where there is no real distinction between home and work and school and hobbies. It's all part of a great tapestry, isn't it? And yet, look at not only how we've structured an institution. We've got entire buildings dedicated for school only. And you sort of scratch your head. If school is not distinct from work, why do we have a separate building for school? And it seems sort of odd. Metadata. We have metadata that's like school metadata. And then we have other metadata, which is work metadata. And they will never meet. Open. The idea that we can store knowledge in closed repositories. And I'm thinking here specifically of things like LCMSs, but more generally, the whole range of institutional repositories that require passwords, authentication, IP checks, and blood types in order to get access to. That idea is fundamentally misguided. And to illustrate, and that's why I'm so pleased. You know, I come here to a conference like this, I look at all the sessions on open source and open software and open content, and I begin to think, it's great, people are beginning to get this. And the argument, in my mind, the argument in favor of open content and open software is really very simple. If you picture the network of knowledge as being like the network of neurons in a mind, then barriers, like copyright limitations, password access, and all of that, that's like putting blockages in the connections between the neurons in your mind. And you know, if people get that, if that happens to a person, if their neurons stop sending signals freely and openly to each other, we consider them to be very sick, fundamentally ill, in need of major care and treatment and support. It's not a healthy, knowing mind at that point, is it? It's certainly not a remembering mind. So anyhow, I did say I'd talk about metadata sometime. So what about metadata? I'm going to shift gears a little bit here. I'm going to take these properties and apply them specifically to metadata. How am I doing on time, please? 45? All right, I'm going to finish a little early. That's fine. Not a lot early. Well, I'm supposed to leave time for questions anyways. I always forget that. They give me 45 minutes, and I say, great, I got an hour. All right. The properties, the three properties that I've just described, are not merely properties of universities. Because, after all, the basic unit of knowledge is not the university. It's, well, I was going to say, when I was writing this, first thing I wanted to say, something much smaller, try to come down, well, what is the basic unit of knowledge? And I realized, uh-oh, I've stumbled into philosophy again. So, I'll dither. Here's the picture that I've been trying to draw so far. I don't know if the different colors come out clearly, but they're there. Those circles, they're not all actually the same. It's just, you know, you try to do a graphic in 5 minutes, you go for the predefined circle, right? But you think of those circles, they're all different, they're all diverse, they're all autonomous, they're all doing their own thing, and they're connected. And the knowledge itself consists in the connections between these circles. And I've got one set of black lines that represents idea A, another set of red lines that represents idea B. That's our knowledge network. The same picture applies at all levels. And there's, you know, I know I'm making a very strong claim here, but I believe, I don't have time to go into all of the detail here on that, I believe there's significant empirical evidence to support this. The same principles that govern interactions between bloggers also cover the distribution of rivers in a river valley, also cover the way crickets chirp in unison. There's the picture. And at the lowest level, if you will, neurons, but also the interconnection between ideas that I've been talking about, interconnection between metadata, interconnection between people, which these days has reached hype status under the heading of social networking, and then, of course, at the top, the interconnection between universities, the mechanism by which you develop an excellent university system. And just for good measure, and I'm not going to linger on this, as you go from the smaller to the larger, you have your causal relationships, but equally importantly, as you go from the larger to the smaller, you have your perceptual relationships. That's the being able to recognize the picture of Richard Nixon as opposed to, say, having the picture of Richard Nixon be caused, or the recognition of Richard Nixon be caused. Now, this is drawn in a nice, neat line. It is not a nice, neat line. I've left out all kinds of... I left out crickets, for one thing. I wasn't sure whether I should put ideas above metadata or metadata above ideas. I don't want to convey the idea here that it's nice, neat layers all the way up. It is not. It is a chaotic mess. But if we abstract it, apply, you know, words to it, this is kind of what we get. Okay. Now that's the background into which I approach metadata. Now, thinking about metadata and thinking about how metadata ought to be organized and structured, I came up with a concept that I called resource profiles. I wrote a paper on that a couple of years ago. A couple of people read it, which was nice. And in that paper, I described three major features of metadata. First of all, there are different types of metadata. What very recently we would call microformats. I'll talk more about all of these. Second, the information in metadata is distributed. And then third, any given perspective, any given point of view, any given context of recognition is the result of aggregation, of bringing things in. Now, just last thing this morning, before I came here and reviewing these, I realized, oh yeah, wait, these are the same principles that I just talked about. So, different types of metadata, diversity. Information is distributed, interwoven. Given perspective is aggregated, open. There is a correspondence there. I'm not sure of the significance of that, but it certainly matched. At least it matched at 7:30 this morning. So let's look at learning object metadata specifically. I'm going to work from the assumption that you are all familiar with learning object metadata. Is that a correct assumption? Okay. How many of you are sitting up? I'll pause for a bit of water here. All right. Learning object metadata is one of your classic standardization exercises. And when I look at learning object metadata, it is the oddest thing in the world to me to see every metadata record having exactly the same structure, no matter what kind of learning object it's describing. It just seems wrong. And it seems to me that we lose a lot when we do that. If you look at different types of resources, I got a couple examples here, but you can multiply them yourself. Look at a video resource and an audio resource. These are two very different types of resources. One will have a bit rate, that'll be the audio. Another will have a frame rate, that'll be the video. The video will have a size, right? The audio size makes no sense. So, there are, or there ought to be, what we might call LOM microformats. If we have learning object metadata that describes an audio resource, then the metadata appropriate to audio resources ought to be a part of that learning object metadata. If, on the other hand, the resource is, say, an essay in Microsoft Word, you use a different type of metadata. If it's a learning object properly so-called with learning outcomes and activities and, you know, the model, then you use different metadata. If the learning object is an opportunity for a one-on-one personal engagement with an online mentor, then you use different metadata. And the different metadata varies. So, you know, you have different technical metadata, you have different educational properties, and so on. We think of learning object metadata as though it's this one big monolithic format. But in so doing, we misshape our descriptions of the objects. Look at the technical elements of metadata. Really, you don't learn anything, well, you don't learn much, about the technical properties of the resource that you're describing, because we've tried to get one size fits all, and we've just sort of fudged it. Look at rights. Yes, description. What kind of rights metadata is that? I mean, it doesn't work at all. But again, because we're trying to get one size fits all, we just wipe out the detail and just go for something, oh, well, this will work for everyone, I guess that'll do. Learning object metadata, too, it just seems odd to me. It's almost like it's in this world apart, like I said earlier. It's school metadata, right? And when we're thinking of learning object metadata as metadata that could be constructed out of other types of metadata, that draws us to the conclusion that we should see learning object metadata as metadata that is situated in an environment where there are other types of metadata surrounding it, and that learning object metadata and these other types of metadata interconnect, interact, and indeed, you would take, say, personal metadata, such as friend of a friend, and actually bring it into the learning object metadata. What do we got instead? We got, what are those things called? Some cards? V cards? Yeah, that's it. I've always been scratching my head over that one. Why there's V card metadata in learning object? Anyhow. Rights metadata, instead of yes, yes, description, we have rich, expressive languages that could be used to express rights in learning objects. But we have to stop seeing learning object metadata as something separate, standalone. We have to invent it all from scratch. When I think of metadata, I think of RSS. RSS is beautiful. RSS, title, description, link, you're done. And then you just add other stuff to it as you need it. And learning object metadata has even recreated title, description, link. It has its own special fields for it. Now, there have been crosswalks built between learning object metadata and Dublin Core, but I sort of wonder, why didn't they just take the core of Dublin Core and say, well, we'll use that. That's what RSS does. You need creator metadata, Dublin Core, DC creator, and you're done. You didn't need a special RSS element for creator. And I'm going to go back, because after all, I do have 44 minutes. Time stands still for me when I'm up here. I want you to think about how limited our conception of what a learning resource could be has become because of the way we've shaped our metadata. Picture a learning object in your mind for a moment, and of course it's all different pictures, right? And ask yourself, how do you represent an event in learning object metadata? Where is the field starts time? And what happens, and you can make it work, right? But now what you're taking these standard fields and now you're kind of using them to your own purpose. You're ignoring the real meaning, properly so-called, of what that field means. You probably put start time in technical resources or something. Yeah, why not? If everybody else that's getting the metadata knows what you mean, doesn't really matter what the word said. Learning object metadata, as it is structured now, actually collapses our view of what a learning resource can be into this static knowledge as something like a sentence picture of learning. But if we break the constraints of vocabulary imposed on us by learning object metadata, we also break the conceptual constraints on what a learning object can be. And then it can be a mentoring session. Then it can be a seminar. Then it can be an organization. Now, what does an organization look like as a learning object? I don't know, but I'd like to be able to describe it. We have this thing, learning object repositories, metadata repositories, and we have this picture of the metadata being like the card catalog, right? How many times have you heard that analogy? The other one is the label on the soup can. But people love the card catalog analogy. And so you have each individual record, each individual card describes the resource for us. And when we want to go locate a learning object, we're going to do just like we do in a library, we go search through the card catalog. Most knowledge isn't organized this way. Think about how we would describe a person in metadata. Think of yourselves as a prospective employer of that person. So, what do you want? Well, if you don't know the person, well, you're not supposed to anyways. So, what you want is person metadata, which these days we call a CV, right? So, the CVs come in, you got these piles, the pile on your desk, that's all the metadata. Now you're going to go through a search process and try to retrieve the records, the people that you want for your position. The question here is, as a potential employer, are you going to depend completely and exclusively on the CV in order to come to conclusions about the attributes of that person? I contend that you would be nuts to do so. And nobody would. Very minimum, we have interviews so that we can get other data. But typically, we do things like we'll run a reference check. I don't know how it works here, but in Canada, we check and see if they have a criminal record. We run it through that sort of database. I don't think we do it in Canada, but they may do it here, so I put it in. You may check their credit history to make sure they're not a bad risk. If they give you a name and an address, you might confirm that in the phone book. The point here is, what we know about a person is not contained in a single metadata record, and indeed, it's not contained even in a single location. And that is crucial for our understanding, our knowledge about that person. And of course, it's all point of view. A prospective employer is interested in one set of personal metadata. A prospective date is interested in a very different set of metadata. And because I couldn't resist, I diagrammed that. I was waiting for it. So we have different types of metadata. This classic CV, which I consider bibliographic metadata. That's the stuff you were born with, right? You know, actually, it doesn't even include name when you're born, unless your parents planned ahead and did ultrasound or whatever. But when I grew up, the name came after the birth. It's age, that's known right from day one, stuff like that. Then you'll have health metadata, which would be located in the doctor's office or in the hospital, or I guess down here they'd be, what are they, HMOs? grades, which would be held at the school, because you're not going to trust the person to provide an accurate transcript of their grades, because if you did, everybody gets A's. The police criminal record, again, you get that directly from the police, the bank, or the, well, I guess you have it here too, Equifax. You get the credit information, which is sometimes accurate, sometimes less so. Information about teeth from the dentist. Now your employer is going to aggregate this information, bring it in, and remix it, and organize it in order to form their own view, their own perspective. CV, grades, health, criminal record. The date doesn't really care about the CV. Well, most dates don't. They're interested in health, criminal record, because they usually do care about that, credit, and so I'm told, teeth. And you can go on, right? I can make this list much longer, and I can come up with different points of view. Learning object metadata is the same way. You have a resource. It is born. Created. It's the fruits of creativity, or you know what I mean. And it has, creation date, it has a parent or an author. You'll give it a name. You'll say, this is a nice learning object. It's about rockets, and so on. And then it goes out into the world. And as it's out there in the world, then it begins to acquire different properties. Fred Pinner used it in a nature class. Joe Jackson thought it was really good and gave it a rating of 5. The Mennonite Central Committee had a look at it and gave it the approval for LDS classes. The Siskel and Ebert of e-learning gave it 2 thumbs up. Oops, this is out of order. Maybe it's not. Maybe I just intended to put a slide there, but didn't. Yeah, well, you adapt. All right. The third point. I really did have something to say that.
Oh, well.
Yeah. Have a drink of water instead. If you ever forget what you want to say, have a drink of water. Think about... Man, it just bugs me. Anyhow, think about your metadata environment. Think about your personal metadata. Even think about your CV, although, you know, maybe think about it a bit more abstractly, because your CV is typically a paper document and has the limitations inherent in physical objects. The metadata about you isn't simply the metadata about you, if you think about it. I live in a house, for example. It's a nice little house. It's on a quiet street in Moncton, New Brunswick, in eastern Canada. That house has metadata. That house is older than I am. See, it had metadata before I did. It has a creation date, which is approximately 80 years ago. It's not very reliable at metadata, because that was before they invented metadata. The house has an address, a street address, a lot description number, and all of that. Has its, you know, has its history of owners, its provenance, and all of that. That metadata describing my house actually exists separately from me. It's down in City Hall. When I give you my metadata, I refer you to my house metadata. Now, typically, I'll just refer you with an address, you know, 25 Portland. But, well, I'm going to have to erase that off the tape. Oops. Right. I'll simply refer you to where you can get more metadata. Same with pets. I got a cat, and the cat came with papers. Cat had its own metadata. Cat's metadata isn't my metadata, because cat might go away, and I continue. I might give the cat with its associated metadata to someone else. Cat might die, in which case I close the file and archive it. Your car, same sort of thing. Car has papers. An entity does not exist in isolation. It's not a sentence like Paris is the capital of France. An entity is related to other entities, inherently related. And we need to express this in metadata. So I call this metadata referencing. And other people call it other things. I don't think this is unique to me, but what it isn't is in love. The metadata about a given resource is not stored in a single file. Rather, as you go through, say, the learning object metadata, from point to point, as you refer to different types of resources, instead of embedding the metadata right in there, you simply point or reference an external metadata file. I've proposed this on a number of fronts. I wrote a paper about expressing digital rights for metadata. And one way of doing it is you can take your digital, your ODRL file or your XRML file, I still have trouble saying MPEG-REL, and embed it, the 80 lines, in the description field of the learning object metadata. That's one way of doing it. And what that means is if you have a million learning objects, then you have this rights information replicated a million times. And if you want to change your price, you're in trouble. But if you take your rights metadata and create a rights model, and you put that in a specific spot, I call it a rights broker, and then in your learning object metadata, you simply point to the location of your rights metadata. And that's what Creative Commons does, right? Creative Commons, you have a web page, read through the web page, there's the little Creative Commons logo, and if you look at the source of the page, you'll see the rights metadata encoded in the page, but what that does is it is a pointer to the canonical definition of, say, non-commercial share alike on the Creative Commons website. And that's how it's done. Well, first, you know, learning object metadata, we've got yes, description. But it's not just that. Look at the authors of resources. And again, we refer to people about half a dozen times in Learning Object Metadata. And every time we've got this embedded B card. And I sit there and I look at these Learning Object Metadata files and I say, well, what happened if the person changed jobs and got a new email address? But who's going to go out and change the 25,000 Learning Object Metadata records to reflect this new information? That makes no sense. But if a person had their own metadata record, friend of a friend is a popular format, not necessarily the definitive format, then in the learning object metadata, you simply have a reference to that person's metadata. Creator, here that person is. That person could change their job, change their address, change their name, and they would not obsolete one learning object metadata file. You see this already in RSS, with the, or I should say more accurately, Atom, with the different link elements. Atom allows you to have several links associated with a resource, and one of the links will be the actual location of the resource, and another link will be a backup location, and another link will be a resource that the current resource talks about, and so on. They're all defined in the Atom 1.0 specs. And you're beginning to find them in web pages as well. And I'll talk a bit about that shortly. So here's the picture. So pretend that this is Learning Object Metadata. I've adapted the vocabulary for my own purposes. So on the Learning Object website, the name, the description, the location, the author. Now the author isn't a string, Stephen Downs, because that's not a good way to store that information. The author instead is a pointer to the author website in my FOF file. And indeed, I work for a company, biggest one in Canada. I don't know if that's true. Anyhow, so under company, it doesn't just say National Research Council. It's a pointer to the company metadata describing that company. If I change jobs, I just change that pointer. If my company changes names, it's a government entity. Could happen. Then they change their thing. I don't need to change anything on mine. The rights on the broker website, and so on. I've just picked a few things here, but we could expand this. This picture gives me two basic principles of distributed metadata. And those of you who are involved in database design should be thinking normalization. Those of you who are not involved in database design may want to Google the concept. This is not original to me. Metadata, and put in the caveat, where possible. Metadata for any given entity should not be stored in more than one place. There should be one canonical location for my name, and that's on my website, not your websites, those of you who are university people. It's on my website because it's my name. And that's the only place it's stored. Now, it can be mirrored, it can be reflected, right? Because, you're thinking about database design. You don't want to be doing lookups across the entire internet every time you go to see a record. So you pull this information in, you mirror it on your own site. Sure, no problem. But the canonical information is stored on my website. And from time to time, you aggregate my information, you bring it in, just to make sure that your information still coincides with my information. And for mission-critical information, you'd be aggregating a lot. And for bibliographical information, you might do it once a month. And the reason for that simply is data integrity. You multiply the location of a piece of data, say my name, you multiply the possibility for errors. My name is spelled Stephen Downes. I can give you 8 different ways of getting that wrong. And they are always gotten wrong. Stephen with a V, Downes without my E. Sometimes they do both. I've had Stephe. And so on. And some of them I do myself, right? Because, you know, I'm typing my name in all these fields all the time. The second principle, and this is the one I think that is most violated by LUM, metadata for a given entity should not, bracket except as a mirror, cache, or whatever, contain metadata for a second entity. We need to keep our entities straight and have separate metadata for the different entities. Now, if you think about it, it's going to give us a lot more expressive power because it is going to allow us, how do I want to describe this? It allows us to do, for example, much more finely grained searches. I did a paper called The Semantic Social Network, where I talked about some of these principles. And the idea is, we have social networks, which really, you know, if you have a person, they list all their friends. And then you have content metadata, like RSS, where you describe, you know, all your blog posts or all your essays or whatever. And right now, these are two separate things. But if you merge them together, that puts friends together with content. Like I put in my newsletter the other day, my social network is my content network. They're one and the same thing. They just have different types of entities. So I could, in principle, if I was a better software author, do a search, find all the papers written by people who are friends of David Wiley. Now, why would I do that? Well, I don't know. I might narrow it down. Find all the papers on learning objects written by people who are friends of David Wiley. That is going to give me, I would bet, an authoritative collection of papers on learning objects. Because I know David Wiley is an authority on learning objects. And his friends are probably also authorities, or at least those who write about learning objects. So you get that kind of multi-type entity search capacity. I'm trying to come up with a phrase off the top of my head. It's always a bit hard. What's important now, remember all my layers, right? These principles apply not just to metadata. They apply to learning resources themselves. We have this picture of learning resources in our mind as though it is like a can of soup. And you stick it in the back shelf, and then you pull it out when you want. But it's not like that. The learning resource itself is distributed. Itself brings in different types of entities. It applies to applications themselves. Now, I'm not talking like Java and all of that sort of thing, but I'm talking more along the lines of separate freestanding applications loosely connected through communication channels, not integrated into one large enterprise piece of software. The web is changing, and it's changing in this very direction. You may have heard the concept Web 2.0. That's not just a slogan. It's a shifting of the idea of the web from being a medium to the idea of the web as a platform, or if you will, an environment. It just is the shift from the idea of the web as being communications, like in that old picture of knowledge, to an environment or a network, or pick your own metaphor, where you're not just dealing with content, you're actually immersed in it, part of it. It becomes a place where you do things. It becomes even a place where you live. E-learning 2.0. I've got a whole other slideshow on e-learning 2.0. Here's the picture. This isn't my picture. It's, Scott Wilson did the original, and Dave Tosh, is that right? Somebody nod. Oh, well, thank you. has done more. The idea of the future virtual learning environment, that's your space. And then you are connected to all these applications, to all this content, to all this data, all this metadata around the web. Those of you, and I bring this up because most of you, all of you, are working on university-centric systems. E-learning 2.0 is not university-centric. E-learning 2.0 is where you're one of those bubbles. You're part of the student, the person's overall learning environment. And your metadata and your interactions, your identity sign-ons, have to play nice with all of these other applications. Not just other universities, but newspapers, blogging sites, dating sites. Different points of view, right? Or as I got here, Flickr, photo sites. Learning becomes a network phenomenon. It becomes not just a place where we receive the service or the content of learning, but it becomes an interactive, back and forward network environment where everybody's receiving, everybody's creating, everybody's remixing. We see social networks and communities, as I talked about before, the semantic social network. Networks of interactions, the personal learning center. We're beginning to see this already in Web 2.0. There's a link down at the bottom, microformats.org, where these microformats are beginning to be developed for embedding in XHTML files. And they've done things like HCalendar, HCard, RHEL, license, a whole bunch of things. There was a new one just came in the other day for video. And these microformats are embedded in web pages or in the future, because this is mostly an XHTML initiative, but in the future they'll be embedded in RSS and other types of XML metadata as well. The Web 2.0 checklist. This is another take on the principles of distributed metadata. Structured microcontent, like I've described. The data is outside. It comes in through the interactions. The bits of the network are not all, it's not all one big monolithic piece of software, like which is running on my computer, but different small pieces of software that talk to each other in application-specific and resource-specific microformats and APIs. That's why you get the Flickr API. That's why you get the Google Maps API. And you use these APIs the way you use media-specific metadata. The single identity, the single place for that personal thing, and I've drafted a proposal on that, it's at that URL there. User-generated, user-managed content, applications, network as a whole. Michael Feldstein yesterday wrote, I quite agree with this, we need a system that is optimized toward slotting in new pieces as they become available, not as an afterthought or an add-on, but as a fundamental characteristic of the system. Try doing that with Blackboard or WebCT. The takeaway, and I am going to come in under time. Charles Vest talked yesterday about the meta-university. If I may be so audacious, this, what I've described here, is the information architecture for the meta-university. Now, you might not agree with all of the details and everything, but it is going to be very much like that. And it is going to be very much like that because, really, that's the only way to do it. The key here is not large integrated systems, but small, flexible bits that are interconnected. And that's true of applications. It's true of content, like websites, pictures, images, graphics, sound. And it's true of metadata. And that leads us to this. I thought it was the last slide, I'm sorry. Learning object metadata will be rewritten, or maybe bypassed entirely. That's a prediction. I'll stake my reputation as a pundit on it. It's going to be rewritten. And it's going to be rewritten because it has to be. And just as, excuse me, as we work with learning object metadata as it is currently incarnated, unless we're working within a large monolithic entity, like, say, the U.S. military, learning object metadata will be found to be too rigid, too inflexible, too narrowly defined to do the sorts of things that we want to do with it. And instead, we're going to get a type of learning object metadata that will be similar to, although I know these committees, will be different from the resource profiles that I've described here, where it will bring in the different types of microformats, where the metadata will be distributed. We will do things like harvest second-party and third-party metadata. That's the slide that was missing. Did I talk about first? Dang, now I remember. First-party metadata. Metadata created by the author. Bibliographic metadata. Second-party metadata. Metadata created by the user of a resource. Evaluation. Context of use. I used this resource in a math class. Third-party metadata. Metadata created by an observer of some sort. The Mennonite Central Committee, the rights broker, the Siskel and Ebert of e-learning. First, second, third-party metadata. Learning object metadata of the future will be composed of these three types of metadata. And the microformats within these three types of metadata will be mixed and matched. Mixed and matched according to the nature of the resource, and mixed and matched according to the perspective, point of view, or context of use of this metadata. And that is my last slide. I thank you very much for inviting me. It has been a pleasure, and I really appreciate you staying for the whole talk. Thank you very much. Yeah. Sorry, I have to rewind. I have to go back to... Oh, that's almost prehistory now. How do I want to put it? All the work that we've done in metadata so far, almost all, the vast majority of it, has been about developing metadata vocabularies. From my perspective, there is probably not a single metadata vocabulary that can be applied universally. And in fact, I'm not even sure it can be applied like bilaterally. What I'm interested in regarding an object is different from what you're interested in. So we're about trying to create this common vocabulary in an environment where idiosyncratic, personal, or niche vocabularies are in fact the norm. And so we have this tension. And we have the group of people who say, look, if we only had an ontology, everything would be good. And then we have the wild-eyed radicals on the other side, tag everything, man. Right, where there's no vocabulary and everything is idiosyncratic. And neither one really works. And so we have this pull. We can't go standardized. If we go standardized, we're going to get what we get even today with LOM, people using standard fields in idiosyncratic ways. And if we go idiosyncratic, we're going to get what we get in tagging, people trying to standardize tags. Everybody tag this NMC 2005. Right? So that's the pull. I think the way out of the pull really is to not, to not get hung up on questions of vocabulary. To me, the metadata for a resource is for the most part in the description. And you just describe the resource in your own. It's like problem for, you know, grade 10 students, right? Describe this in your own words. And if you do that, then there's enough commonality in language and enough idiosyncrasy in personal needs that you'll get that kind of blend. But I'm still wrestling with that.
As an educator, your two paradigms for knowledge have a very familiar resonance. You have the, what I certainly is the traditional paradigm, perhaps still the dominant one, that a knowledge is created by a scholar who climbs up into his ivory tower, locks himself away, and 30 years later comes down to students for trivia. And then you have the view that you argue for, that meaning is socially constructed, and that students should learn from a variety of sources. The first paradigm is that you have the sage on the stage, you have the canonical textbook, and everything is in it, and you learn it, and it lasts you for your lifetime. The network paradigm is that students learn from each other, from a variety of sources, and this is a process that goes on throughout their lifetime.
Sure. I do want to be a bit careful, though, because there's nuance here when we say meaning is socially constructed, because I want to be careful not to get all Vygotsky and like it's all social, because like I have a head and inside my head is a brain, and it's a fully functioning operating unit most of the time, right? And so strictly speaking, I could have meaning without society. Now, not meaning in a Wittgensteinian sense, where I know all the time what my words mean, but nonetheless, you know, there's two levels of meaning operating here. There's meaning how I understand the words, and that really is internal. And then there's meaning what the words mean in a wider sense, and that's social. But it's social only as an emergent property from the individual. And it's not a process of construction per se. It's a process of aggregation and recognition. And that's all I really can say on that at this time.
Thank you very much, Stephen. We now have a break.